Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Wednesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. A reminder that we're Zooming this show on Tuesday afternoon, so, well, you catch my drift. Anyway, we've begun our show now every single day with a fabulous bit of political verse. As I say, Calvin Trillin is to the nation as Skip Tenzar is to the Attitude. So now, hit it, Ken.
Istanbul was Constantinople, now it's Istanbul, now Constantinople, been a long time gone, Constantinople, now it's Turkish delight on a moonlit night.
Senator Graham is nosing around the state of Georgia like a bloodhound, asking about tossing ballots, leaving a bad taste on palates. Poor Lindsay's nose is permanently brown.
We'll just like it better that way.
So take me back to Constantinople, no you can't go back. Constantinople, been a long time gone. Constantinople, why did Constantinople get the works?
All right, everyone. Joining us right now for the first interview of The Attitude is Joshua Keating. He's a senior editor at Slate. He focuses on international affairs and is the author of Invisible Countries. But what we're going to be talking to him about is his piece that was entitled, Whatever Trump is Doing, It Isn't a Coup. But the long-term effect could be similarly damaging. So let me welcome Joshua to the program. And I guess I got to begin by saying this. So you say it's not a coup. I kind of think it is a coup. So you define coup, and then we can sort of debate this issue. Welcome to the program.
Thanks, Arnie. Thanks for having me. Yeah, so I mean, this has been a kind of like fixation of mine for the last couple of years of what is or isn't a coup, and not normally the kind of question I'd be applying to US politics, but that's where we are. Well, you could say what Trump's doing is a little closer to what they call a self-coup or an autogolpe, which is where the authorities use extra constitutional means to remain in office or seize more power. The thing is, like most of the traditional examples of a coup you can point to involve some degree of military power. There's always, you know, even if the coup is not violent, what's behind it is the threat of violence. And, you know, despite, you know, some of the people who came driving down my street the other day, heading for the Capitol for the rally on Saturday, I think one thing we are lucky to be able to count on in the U.S. is a military that's fairly professional, mostly stays out of political contests, and whose loyalty is to the Constitution, rather than to any one particular politician. So I'd say in that respect, what we're seeing right now is does not have a lot in common with what we traditionally look at as coups around the world.
So you kind of answered the question that I was going to pose to you, which is, I know the militia. I've known the militia for a long time. We had the White Mountain Militia. I kind of got to meet them in 1988. So, you know, militias are us, and everyone thinks it's kind of a new phenomena. It ain't, sweetheart. It's been around for a long time. The difference, however, is because of social media, they're able to coordinate a lot more effectively. Since 1988, they have a lot more ammunition. They have a lot more bullets. They own, like, basically caches of weapons. And I know that it's not the quote-unquote military, but it does have a feel of using some kind of muscle that, while it's not an official military, it almost feels like Donald Trump's military. Do you know what I mean? It's not my military, but it feels more like Trump's military, number one. And number two, as I was talking to Ken before you came on the air, you know, we're not done yet, okay? So we haven't sworn in Joe Biden. And a lot can happen in the next couple of days or weeks. But the other thing is there has been a significant decapitation at the Department of Defense. And so Trump is rearranging the deck chairs. So what existed, you know, maybe a week and a half ago doesn't exist today. And when you put your people in and you are basically sort of suggesting that this was a stolen election, you are a guy who does not want to leave office for a lot of reasons, because maybe you'll end up in jail if you do. I'm just wondering whether, as you wrote this piece, looking what's happening out there now, is it possible that we can sort of stretch that definition of coup because of, one, the Trump military, the militia, and because of what he's doing at DOD?
Well, you know, you look at like a sort of a classic example of a coup, like say what happened in Peru in 1992, where President Alberto Fujimori, with the backing of the military, he dissolved Congress, he suspended civil liberties, established government by decree. I mean, you know, and believe me, I don't want to sound like sanguine about what's happening now. I don't want to say like our democracy is in a healthy place by any means. But, you know, what we haven't seen anything comparable to that yet. What we've seen is, you know, the Trump campaign firing a flurry of basically toothless lawsuits in courts, which, you know, just right before we went on air, another one got thrown out by the Supreme Court in Pennsylvania. So, you know, it's so far he is proceeding through the established institutions of our government and, you know, hitting a brick wall with it. I do think the firings in the Department of Defense are troubling. I don't see those necessarily as signs that, you know, he's putting loyalists in place for a power grab. I mean, I think that there are a number of things he wants to do in his last few months when it comes to declassifying information, to, you know, rapidly withdrawing troops, as they announced today, from Iraq and Afghanistan, and that he wanted his people in there for it. And I also think it's possible he may just still believe he's going to win this, and is, you know, putting, you know, these are definitely the moves of a person who doesn't necessarily think they're actually going to be out of power in 2 months, even if they're not necessarily moves that'll help him hold on to power.
So you write in your piece, and I want to sort of go beyond this. You write, even if what's happening in the U.S. right now isn't really a coup, Trump's actions have a similar corrosive effect on the country's political culture. We can take the warning signs from other countries and histories. So what and you use the term coup trap. So let's explain to my audience what you mean by a coup trap, because I do think he is softening us up for the next autocrat, for the next dictator, someone who's a little more skilled than Donald Trump, who isn't using a blunt instrument, but knows even more about how the workings of government actually operate. I mean, that's maybe our gift, is that Donald Trump is clueless. You know, he just sort of takes out, he wants to just destroy everything. And in the end, he ultimately destroyed himself. Well, if someone a little more sophisticated, because he's kind of softened us up, will know that you don't destroy it. What you do is you pull certain levers and then you get the result you want.
Yeah, so I mean, coup traps, when there are political scientists who do sort of forecasts, who do almost sort of Nate Silver style forecasting of coup risk. And one of the biggest factors they look at is whether a country has had a coup recently. I mean, it's really that, you know, once the ice is broken and, you know, it becomes normalized for usually the military to step in and overrule the democratic process, then it significantly raises the risk that it's gonna happen again. You look at a country like Thailand, where we see a lot of, we've seen mass protests in the past few weeks. They've had more than a dozen military coups over the past century. You know, like a Turkey, which had, you know, half a dozen coups in the second half of the 20th century. You know, several countries in West Africa you'd put in the coup trap category. So, you know, what happens is it really corrodes the legitimate institutions of a country's politics. And I think that could happen here. I mean, as you say, like, it's almost like he's sort of probing vulnerabilities. You know, what we've learned in this process is that a lot of what determines the changeover in government depends not on, you know, codified law, but on these sort of norms and unwritten rules. And, you know, that if the election been closer, had it come down to one state instead of four states, had it been within 0.5% instead of, you know, whatever it is in Pennsylvania, you know, I definitely think, you know, we could have, again, seen an election decided in the courts. We could have seen the armed militia groups we were talking about earlier, playing a role in sort of intimidating public officials. You know, I think that, you know, the fact was this election like wasn't actually close enough that a lot of that stuff was going to work. Knock on wood. we still have to get through the next 2 months, but, you know, that shouldn't give us any false sense of security. I think it just shows, you know, we probably escaped this time, but next time it might not be so lucky.
Yeah, Ken, you wanted to weigh in?
Yes, thank you. I have to disagree with the notion that Trump might be trying to lay the groundwork for a coup next time, or even in the coup trap notion of trying to make the country more vulnerable to a coup. My sense of this man is that he does not have much capacity for trying to change things for future generations or even 4 years from now. He's all about number one at the moment. And I think he just wants to make the best for himself. And perhaps, yes, Josh, he's doing things within institutions. He's filing lawsuits. But I think he wants all the pieces in place so that if he decides to do something, the military will not be rabidly against him, or they won't act fast. Maybe they'll think about it, and they'll think about it too long. But he's preparing so that if there is a little window, if there's some mistake, if there's anything that he can or that he thinks he can run with, even plausibly, any kind of plausible thing that goes wrong during a Georgia runoff election process or anything that he feels like he can do something, he will do it, and he will have the pieces in place to support his efforts, or at least not to fight him so hard.
But I think Joshua, that's your point about the self coup. I mean, his whole raison d'etre is basically to say this is not a real election, that this election was stolen. This is about questioning sort of the democratic institutions. And unlike in a coup, where, as you point out before, there is this military muscle or an implied military muscle behind the ability to either grab power or shift power, what you've got here is a guy who, it's a replay. It's what he said in 2016 when he freaking won. He said it again in 2020 when he lost. There's a theme here. And the only theme here is that he wants to basically challenge anything that represents sort of a democratic process where people get to pick and choose. The only one he wants to get to pick and choose is himself.
Right. I mean, I should clarify, I don't think he's sort of intentionally laying the groundwork for anyone to follow. What I'm saying, he is, I think you're right, acting in a fairly transparently self-interested manner. But, you know, that doesn't mean that, you know, the institutions that come up after him aren't going to learn from the course of action that he takes here and, you know, couldn't apply some of it in a more like disciplined approach in a case where the election might have been a little more ambiguous.
So Joshua, the thing that bothers me about this though is that I do think he has weakened the institutions. I do think that we actually thought that the norms would hold. You know, we're thinking that maybe something along the lines of the three branches of government, the democracy is kind of held, but we thought that the norms would hold. So now the question is, maybe we need to codify what is a norm. So is there a possibility of codifying some of those norms, given the fact that we have a Mitch McConnell, we have a Lindsey Graham that's trying to shake down the GOP Secretary of State in Georgia and basically saying you should throw out some ballots so that Donald Trump can win. I mean, and he's a powerful, powerful Republican senator in the U.S. Senate. So I am looking at how the Republican Party has seemed to have a sort of a lobotomy, you know, and the lobotomy is anything that deals with process and democracy and integrity and whatever, that seems to have sort of been removed from them. And the question is, as soon as Donald Trump goes, will they get it back? Will they care about process? Or will we have to put something in place that actually is, quote unquote, a law? But how do you pass a law when those boys may be in control again, depending on what happens in Georgia? I think they like the fact that the system is so, pardon the expression, limp.
Yeah, look, I mean, I usually write about other countries that are in these problems, not the U.S. And, you know, something that, you know, speaking to a researcher on political violence a few weeks ago, and Rachel Kleinfeld, and one thing he was telling me is, you know, we think of the U.S. as an old democracy, as a sort of consolidated democracy with these long established, you know, institutions that go back to the 18th century. You know, but on the other hand, you know, in a lot of ways, we're a very new democracy. We only really sort of integrated a large portion of the U.S. population into that democracy and gave them the right to participate in it. And, you know, in the 1960s, if even then. So, you know, in a lot of ways, we are quite new and have a lot in common with, you know, post-colonial countries in Africa and Asia that are kind of, and I think that what you learn from those cases, those kind of post-colonial experiences, is that, you know, it takes a few generations for, you know, these four democratic institutions to be built up to the point where they hold. And you know, I was talking before about the coup trap that, like, you know, these sort of seismic events that, you know, rock a democracy can have long lasting effects. And so, you know, I don't think this is like going to be, you know, in the next 4 years, I don't think we're going to be able to, you know, pass the laws that are going to be able to prevent something like this from happening again, you know, whether or not they take the Senate in Georgia, well, whatever Mitch McConnell does. I mean, I think it's going to be you know, at least several election cycles, if not several generations, before, you know, we can really sort of breathe easy that the risk of something like this.
Except when you realize that 70 million people voted for Donald Trump. Donald Trump still has his echo chamber, although he's pissed off at Fox News. And I guess maybe here's my concern is that you're saying it's not a coup. And you're using the technical definition of coup. And I'm looking at an article at Vox. And there was a guy who said, the problem is we're using it more of a colloquial sense, meaning some sort of illegal or bad or undemocratic attempt to seize or maintain power. And I think that's my problem, is that when I look at Donald Trump, I see coup. I don't necessarily understand your definition, because your definition is precise. You're the coup expert. I'm the, oh my God, this is undemocratic and you're trying to seize power expert. And well, that's kind of a lot of, that's word salad. Coup is so nice because in a lot of ways it's short, it's simple, and it says something is rotten here. And you are basically ignoring what normally happens in an election and you have this peaceful transfer of power. You are trying to stop that. And in my mind, when I think of the word coup, it's trying to stop or steal what would be a transfer of power.
Yeah, I mean, I think it gets a little fuzzy. I mean, the word coup gets thrown around a ton, and it often just means, you know, the other side is doing something I don't like. I mean, Donald Trump, of course, called his impeachment a coup.
Yeah.
Benjamin Netanyahu called the criminal charges filed against him in Israel a coup. So it is sort of it's like fake news, you know, it's sort of like in the eye of the beholder. I mean, I think that like it is important. I understand what you're saying. And I by no means like this isn't in any way to, you know, make us feel optimistic or to qualify what Trump's doing. But I think it is useful to make these distinctions and a coup has a specific legal context in right. The way the US conducts foreign policy as well. I mean, we're sort of required by law, for instance, to cut off military aid to any country that undergoes a military coup. So I guess I'm just sort of a little reluctant to just sort of open up the definition to sort of any sort of illegitimate political behavior.
So there's a couple of things. One is that in a way, because I think he's kind of eroded so much of what we think or expect over the last 4 years. And we have sort of, in a way, almost given him a pass because, oh, it's just Trump. Oh, we're just humoring him. Oh, just this. Anybody else would be impeached yesterday, not once, but 24 times. And so I feel in a lot of ways, if it isn't a coup, can we come up with a word? Because it feels like a slow motion coup in the sense that whatever he's doing, he has been slicing and dicing everything that we sort of believed in. It was more than norms. It was more than norms. And that's kind of the problem, is what Donald Trump is doing to the United States. We don't even have a language for, Josh. We don't, because we've never really seen it to the extent we've seen it. But just watching Lindsey Graham behaving in Georgia, I'm thinking not only is this toxic, but it's infectious. I mean, you know, I mean, John McCain was an old friend. You know, I keep looking up in the heaven going, oh, my freaking God, you know, talk to him, you know. But see, that's my problem, is that I think he is so eroded so much of what we think is right and wrong, that even if we can't call it a coup, he's rotted something out, and it's not just him, despite what Ken says. I understand it's all about him, but it ain't all about him anymore because of the 70 million that voted for him and because of the fact that the Republicans are still willing to carry his water.
Yeah, and I mean, he's not gonna go away too. I mean, I'd say like, if there's a reason why I'm not like more panicked right now, it's because I think Trump telegraphed fairly clearly you know, for years that this was how it was going to work. Like, I don't think, you know, is it tragic that he's not recognizing the obvious results of a democratic election? Of course it is. But I think that's like the tragedy that began when he was elected 4 years ago. It's not like I think we knew this was more than likely how he was going to respond. And it seems like, thankfully both the Biden campaign and the large portions, if not all, the media were prepared for it and are calling it like it is and sort of denying him sort of any sort of legitimacy. We have to hope that at least this time that's enough.
So I'm kind of curious because I was talking about the militia before, and I'll get to you in a second, Ken. And yep. I hate to say this out loud, but I kind of was expecting more violence. Can I say that out loud? And I haven't seen it. And there is, I guess I'm grateful because there were so many states where he lost, and that kind of maybe, even if they think that it was stolen, it's hard to explain how many of these states were stolen so that you could maybe tamp it down. I also think that what is sadly working against Donald Trump is the pandemic. Because I think that there would be, I mean, when you saw his million man MAGA march, which there weren't even close to a million, I'm not even sure there were 100,000. A lot of the reason was that I think even those people didn't want to get on a plane or a bus, and they didn't want to congregate. And maybe even if they say they don't want to wear a mask, they don't want to die. And, you know, they figured the way that they might go would be with a gun. Now they may go with a COVID. So I guess that is the only reason why I will not use the word coup, because I think he hasn't been able to sort of materialize the sort of military frightening chaos in the streets that he thought was going to happen, in part because he had such a quote unquote loss with those states, but he also had an incredible loss with the pandemic. The pandemic is actually fighting him now, as opposed to him aiding and abetting it. It's actually kind of hurting him in a way I think he didn't quite understand. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I mean, well, there are two things I kind of want to respond to there. First is, you know, it going downtown here in DC in the last few weeks before the election and seeing all the stores boarded up,
right,
was just a really kind of sad reflect. I mean, no matter which side you think is going to perpetrate the violence, and, you know, it's just kind of a sad reflection of where we are, that we think it's impossible to hold an election in this country without violence on the streets. I mean, it didn't happen. And I think it's important that we not treat that as like a self-fulfilling prophecy, that we not just sort of assume that we can't have these processes with violence, because I think that it's almost like when we expect it, that some that can almost make it
happen.
Secondly, I don't remember what the second thing was.
Well, no, the boarding of the streets, they boarded up buildings in New York City. They boarded up buildings everywhere. I mean, I was in Grant Park when Barack Obama won in Chicago. It was like a miracle. It was like church. It was like people were exuberant, but I never had a sense of fear that they would have to board up buildings anywhere in the country in 2008. And yet in 2020, he has almost encouraged us to assume some level of violence because that's really kind of what he demands. And I guess in some ways, maybe he's disappointed because it didn't happen, or at least it hasn't happened. And yet I think part of the reason it hasn't happened is in part because the pandemic is just terrifying everyone. And isn't it sad that we need this horrific situation in order for us to sort of feel like this isn't going to be the result that he sort of wants. And I really do think that COVID is a lot behind it. Maybe I'm wrong.
It's interesting. I wrote a piece shortly before the election about the impact of the pandemic on democracy around the world. And I think that when, you know, in April and May, I wrote a bunch of pieces about how this was disastrous, that like governments were going to use, you know, COVID protection measures as a pretext to clamp down on dissent. And it's interesting, I almost feel like the opposite has happened, that it's rather than sort of forcing people to stay in their homes. It's really sort of galvanized protests in a lot of places. You know, you look at what's happening in Belarus or in Thailand or in several countries, you've seen sort of unprecedented uprisings against authoritarian governments. And I think it's also exposed a lot of those governments. It's sort of revealed how hollow a lot of their, it's sort of exposed strongman rule as right. being, you know, totally ineffective at dealing, you know, even Krastev, who's a Bulgarian political scientist, he writes, authoritarians only like to tackle problems they create themselves. And this was something that was, you know,
well, that's Donald Trump. Important.
So rather than, you have to, like, what would this have been if Donald Trump had just tried, if he had like put in the barest amount of effort, I have to feel like he would have cakewalked a re-election. Like it wouldn't have even been close, but he couldn't sort of bring himself to do it. And, you know, I think that's a big reason why, God willing, he's going to be out of office in a couple of weeks.
Yeah. Ken, real quickly before we close this off.
Yeah. I certainly understand why you don't want to call this a coup, but it really undermines our democracy and our democratic processes to have what Trump is doing. And I too, like Arnie, was afraid there would be more violence. And I still am afraid because, you know, Trump said, stand by, you Proud Boys and you crazy gunmen. And they did stand by, and they are standing by. And this fits in with what I was saying earlier about him having the military maybe not so quick to push him out of office. If he wants to call on those folks again on January 19th to come stand by or before the Electoral College meets, he can do that. And I'm not 100% confident that he isn't going to do that and that we don't have problems ahead. And that is just scary. And I think that erosion has taken place. It's going to take quite a while for Biden and the next couple of administrations to.
I don't think they're going to come. And let me just say something, Josh. When I heard that the governor of Iowa has now mandated a mask mandate across the entire state of Iowa, I'm thinking this is a cakewalk now. When we got people who basically said, oh, this is stupid, we don't need to do this. I think the pandemic is such a damper on this because in the end, they don't mind if they shoot someone. But when they have to start walking over the bodies of their own family members, of their own nurses, of their own doctors, when they're seeing the lines moving out of their hospitals in their rural communities and places where they thought it wasn't going to happen, I think Donald Trump's failure, as you point out, Joshua, is going to basically make them pay attention. And I'm just hoping that not only do we learn from this experience, but that I hope it doesn't soften us up for something that may come next. I think that maybe in a lot of ways, maybe we will become more vigilant and more aware. Is that possible?
I would hope so. I mean, I think it's, you know, like I said, I think that rather than it has really kind of activated a lot of dissent around the world and including in the US. I mean, I don't think that the protests we saw over the summer would have been as widespread or, you know, as passionate if not for the pandemic. So, you know, not that I would
advocate
a trade-off, but, you know, I think that it, you know, we did see a response to it. And hopefully that doesn't end just because Trump's out of office, because it can't. It has
it
to
can't.
Continue.
Absolutely can't. Joshua Keating.
And I understand everything you're saying, Ken. I do believe that on January 20th at noon, whatever Trump has to say about it, the military is going to pivot away from Trump toward the new elected president. And if I'm wrong, you can have me back if we're still
yours to God's ears, baby.
You can tell me I'm wrong.
That's right. And then I'm going to be waiting for Cy Vance to start throwing the book at Donald Trump. I'm already measuring him for a jumpsuit. And on that note, Slate.com, check out the article by Joshua Keating. Whatever Trump is doing, it isn't a coup, but the long-term effect could be similarly damaging. And that's where we need to be vigilant. Thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate it, Joshua.
Thanks, Arnie. Always a pleasure.
All right. Stick around, everyone. We'll be right back. This is the Wednesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes.
I fought the
Welcome back to part two of the Wednesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. Again, I'm reminding everyone that we are Zooming the show on Tuesday afternoon. I saw this article at the New Republic, and we've actually been talking a lot about corruption on the show. We talked about it when Elizabeth Warren was running for president because she used the word corruption a lot when she was in the primary mode. We interviewed Bill Curry, one of our fabulous guests who shows up every Friday, and he talks a lot about corruption and how we really have to go back and investigate it and deal with it and address it, because if we don't address it, it'll repeat itself. So I go to the New Republic and I went, oh, Matt Ford, I'm so glad you wrote this piece. The case for prosecuting Trump and his cronies. How Biden treats his predecessor could determine the fate of American democracy. So I'm going to welcome Matt Ford to the program. And again, reminding everyone that we're Zooming on Tuesday afternoon. And as I'm reading this article, Matt, and I'm so excited about having you come on the air, I then hear that Joe Biden has made a statement on Tuesday afternoon about the fact that he doesn't want to be divisive. He doesn't want to look back. And he would rather not investigate Trump, preferring unity. I will just tell you right now, I had my finger down my throat, but I wasn't surprised. So welcome to the program, Mr. Ford.
And thank you
for writing this article. And let's talk about what you actually wrote in the New Republic. And then I think you and I are probably not quite so surprised at Joe Biden's response this afternoon on Tuesday.
Well, yeah, Biden, he gets caricatured a lot on the right as this sort of radical. He's a vessel for socialism, all of this sort of extreme rhetoric. But in reality, he's widely known to be a pragmatic and a moderate and an institutionalist and somebody who his willingness to shake up things does not really extend to politics. I think what we're going to see is his belief in the innate sort of civic character of Republicans could come back to haunt him in this particular aspect of how his presidency unfolds.
Well, what's so interesting to me is that, so I'm looking at your article and I'm like, yes, team fight. We're going to prosecute Trump and his cronies. And of course, that depends on what Joe Biden wants to do. Then I see Joe Biden basically saying, oh, I want to look ahead. I don't want to look back. I don't want to investigate Trump. And then today, again, Tuesday afternoon on CNN, there apparently was a witness to Lindsey Graham basically trying to threaten the Republican Secretary of State of Georgia about tossing ballots. And I'm thinking, can you show that story to Joe Biden, please? Because he knows Lindsey Graham really, really well. They've been around the block together for a long time. And the old Lindsey ain't the new Lindsey. And the new Lindsey has so sold out that you have to ask yourself, is there value in not addressing the level of corruption that occurred while Donald Trump was president? And the corruption doesn't just impact the 4 years he was president. He started to sort of corrupt his fellow U.S. senators who now he has to work with. Why would he be giving them a pass, Matt Ford?
Well, I think there's certainly an understandable impulse on Biden's part to not want to have his presidency be consumed with what happened with the previous presidency, right? He wants to have his own agenda, his own sort of vision for the country, and he wants to focus on that. And, to some extent, that's fine. But at the same time, I think that he's going to find himself battling against certainly the pressure from a lot of other people on the left to really acknowledge that what happened over the last 4 years was not some sort of, isolated thing, not some sort of easily looked over thing. It was something that calls out for accountability. It calls out for consequences. And if that is in the form of prosecutions by the Justice Department, I think a lot of people on the left are going to say, the president shouldn't stand in that way.
So a couple of things. I understand that right now he needs to say what he's saying. And let me tell you, I'm going to give him a pass on this for this reason. I've been screaming at the TV. I scream on my radio show that the pandemic is the economy. And as we're seeing, people losing their jobs, we're seeing bankruptcies beginning to accelerate. We're realizing that we're closing businesses that will never be, reopened again. That will never really be repaired until we really get a handle on the pandemic. And of course, the problem is we now know that there's some sort of vaccine, but the vaccine will not really be available to a lot of us until 4 or 5 months from now. And in 4 or 5 months, given what we've been living through for the last, 6 or 7 months, I mean, the level of disaster is incomprehensible, okay? Especially when you look at state and local governments' inability to respond, whatever. So he can focus on the economy. But let's also understand that Donald Trump has this incredible four-year record of corruption and self-dealing, all right? And conflicts of interest. And what bothers me, Matt, and this is why I'm going to scream about this, is that if we give him a pass, that has been the story of his life in New York. It was a story of his life in New Jersey. Now it's a story of his life as president. And there is a double standard here. If you are rich and powerful, you get a pass. Take a look at what happened after the 2008 economic meltdown. Name me a bank president that did a perp walk. Name me anyone that did. And yet they brought an economy to the knees. And when I go back and look at what happened after the savings and loan, a bunch of bankers went to jail. But nobody went to jail after the 2008. Because again, you have Barack Obama didn't want to look back, I guess. You know, and that to me, once again, reinforces, I think, a tremendous sense of unfairness and a lack of real justice in this country is that it isn't just that Black lives matter. It's that rich lives are the only ones that matter and get a pass.
Well, I think just to piggyback off what you said about the Obama era and looking back, I think you can make the argument, too, that the impunity that was given to George W. Bush era officials on things like torture, to economic figures on things like, you know, mortgage and securities fraud. I think it created a culture of impunity that arguably led to some of the problems we see today. If Obama had gone harder after CIA officers who commit torture, you have to wonder if people at ICE and people at Customs and Border Protection would have been sort of as gung-ho about their human rights violations over the past few years as they have been under Trump.
Exactly. And that's why what I'm trying to figure out is that we know that we're going to keep the House. So at least if nothing else, we're going to be able to get with Joe Biden in office, we're going to be able to get the records and the disclosures and the information that we were not able to get because Donald Trump would never share any of that with the House of Representatives. That now becomes available. Is there a way for Joe Biden to sort of say, focus on the pandemic and the economy, and the House be able to sort of say, oh, and look at this disclosure, and look at this conflict, and look at it. So if nothing else, they don't get, it doesn't disappear into the ether. That is just so wrong, because if nothing else, I think it does lay a foundation that you can get away with it. You just have to make sure that you buy the next election and you change the next sense of group of majorities. And guess what? You can sort of lay the foundation. We just talked about this is not a coup, but it's a self-coup, all right? That what's happening with Donald Trump, but that what he's doing is he's softening democratic institutions. I think what Joe Biden is doing by giving Donald Trump a pass and only looking forward is that he's aiding and abetting the softening of democratic institutions.
I mean, that's certainly the real risk that happens here. I argue in the piece that if he continues to allow these sort of violations to go uncorrected, it's only going to encourage further abuses in the future. And, you know, to touch upon what you said earlier as well, I think that there's a fair point to be made that if Joe Biden has to spend his day trying to battle the pandemic, or he has to choose between that or worrying about what charges Trump will face, I think it's fairly natural that most people will want him to focus on the pandemic.
Of course.
But the fortunate thing is that Joe Biden is not the only person in the federal government. You know, he can devote all his energies to the pandemic and let the Justice Department simply do its work. There are certainly enough indications out there of wrongdoing on Trump's part, especially on, as you mentioned, on corruption, that Biden shouldn't really need to step in. And as we've seen with this president and the Justice Department, sort of guide things to get an outcome that reaffirms democratic norms.
So here's the question. Who does he pick as AG?
Because
this is the $64,000 question, because the person he picks as attorney general will basically give you a sense of how vigorous that person will be, because you're making the assumption that they will be there to sort of effectively deal with corruption. But, you know, you and I both know it's the direction in which you sort of move that office. What is Elizabeth Warren's great line? Personnel is policy. Well, you know, I think who he picks as AG is going to tell us whether he's actually going to really deal with corruption, because there may be someone who understands what Biden wants and will deliver what Biden wants.
No, I couldn't agree more. I've argued in the past that, you know, this is going to be the most consequential pick Joe Biden makes, unless he has the opportunity to nominate a Supreme Court justice. It'll be the most important one he chooses for his presidency, whether that's 4 years or 8 years. because this person, as we've seen during the Trump administration, plays a hugely influential role in all sorts of policy matters, on immigration, on criminal justice. They are very powerful. And then you add on top of that, the possibility that they could oversee the prosecution of a former president. This is a huge one. And, you know, the names that we've heard floated so far don't really give us a perfectly clear answer one way or the other. You know, we've heard names like Doug Jones, the defeated senator from Alabama, former federal prosecutor, experienced in civil rights cases. We've heard Javier Becerra. He's the California Attorney General. A lot of experience fighting the Trump administration in court. These are people who are not exactly known for taking a lenient approach towards Donald Trump. Same with Sally Yates, the former Deputy Attorney General in the Obama era, who was actually fired by Trump. So far, the names that we've heard haven't really suggested people who will, you know, instinctually decline to pursue legitimate pathways for investigation.
So Matt Ford, I was telling someone that I was interviewing you from the New Republic and about the prosecuting Trump and his cronies. And he said, maybe what Joe Biden is thinking, and I can sort of play with this, is that he knows that once Trump leaves office, even if he pardons himself, that he can't pardon himself for what he did in New York, because this is about his corruption before he was president. And so maybe what Joe is hoping is, I don't have to go after him because everybody else will be going after him. Because, you know, if he pardons himself for whatever he's done when he was in the White House, and he does a blanket pardon of his entire family, including, you know, who knows what, that in a lot of ways, this will just lay bare that you elected a corrupt president. And if he was corrupt before he got into the White House, imagine what he did when he got into the White House. And in a lot of ways, he's kind of hoping that New York will take this responsibility and burden from him so that he can sort of look forward as they're basically trying to figure out which state penitentiary he'll be in.
Well, I mean, there's certainly something to be said for that. You know, the Manhattan District Attorney's Office is fighting pretty hard to obtain his tax returns. The New York Attorney General's Office is also looking into some of the Trump Organization's records and dealings in terms of fraud and things like that that we've heard about for years about how that organization does business. You know, Biden probably wants that.
I think he does.
Right. And I can see why. And, you know, I do think that as long as, you know, the question here is, what sort of Justice Department does he want? What sort of rule of law does he want? If the Justice Department goes out and finds, look, you know, the federal criminal code is voluminous, but it doesn't cover all sins, we don't have a solid case here to prosecute Trump, Biden would probably be pretty happy with that. But as long as he does not adopt the stance that Trump has taken, where he has the sort of prerogative to guide prosecutions, as long as Biden doesn't go into the Justice Department and say, look, you know, let's get him off scot-free in the interest of reconciliation or civic well-being or what have you, that would really be a stretch that I think would alienate a large portion of his base from him. And it would run counter to his aspirations to put the country beyond Trump by replicating his behavior.
And so I think the other thing that has him completely gun-shy on this issue, Joe Biden, is that Donald Trump constantly was talking about arresting everyone. I mean, like Hillary Clinton and Bill Clinton. And I mean, so in a lot of ways, he's almost has a knee-jerk reaction, Matt, to even hearing those words, because the way Trump was so cavalier in using those words against anyone he didn't like. And so because of that, I think he doesn't want those words coming out of his administration, period, because he wants to sort of put a stop to the language that Trump was so comfortable in using.
Right. And you know, I after this piece went online, I've gotten emails from folks that say, you know, you want to put Donald Trump in prison. That's just like what the Soviet Union did. That's just what, like what the Chinese do. You know, this is not how democracies work. And, you know, I will say that, you know, there should be a high bar for prosecuting foreign political officials simply because it's destabilizing a democracy. If, you know, every election people have to worry about them getting arrested by the winners, you know, police forces. But I think what we've seen over the last 4 years is that Trump has sort of removed himself from that norm. He's removed himself from the idea that presidents should be sort of not prosecuted or not pursued for these things in the interest of civic comity, because he's shown such an extreme willingness to violate that himself. Exactly. It's almost ironic that, you know, the guy who has shouted lock him up for 4 years has basically forfeited the argument that could have been his best defense.
Well, again, he's grateful for the decades of the corruption that Donald Trump embraced before he got into the White House. And in a lot of ways, so, I mean, why send him to jail for this, or why, you know, indict him for this when, you know, he's already going to be sort of a wounded puppy. He's already going to be looked at upon as someone who, you know, embraced illegal activity, if not criminal activity. So I think in a lot of ways, he's just lucky that this guy was such a slug. and had a history of it. But going forward, he wants to go forward. And one of the things that we've learned with Donald Trump is that the norms didn't hold, or at least they were really challenged. Is there a series of things, Matt, that even if we don't prosecute or we don't have an AG who is going to be given their head and the license to look? And remember, it's not just Donald Trump that you want to be looking at. I mean, there's a whole cast of characters that he brought in that did things that were highly questionable, if not illegal. So let's remember, you don't have to go after Donald Trump, but if you can go after another 10 or 12 people, that'll send a strong message as well. So I'm hoping that happens. But what could Joe Biden do to inoculate us going into the future?
Well, that's a really good question. I think part of it is sort of modeling good government and ensuring that the Justice Department and federal law enforcement agencies are given the combination of discretion and oversight necessary to do their jobs in a functioning society. There are deeper legal changes that can be made. I know that some have been proposed by think tanks here in Washington in terms of anti-corruption reforms. You know, you mentioned Elizabeth Warren. She's had a package of reforms around lobbying and disclosures and campaign finance. I think those would be positive and substantive steps towards sort of reining in the environment that gave rise to Trump. But, you know, the honest answer is that this is up to the American people. And as long as the American people are willing to, although thanks to the Electoral College, it wasn't as clear cut, but, you know, as long as voters are willing to tolerate somebody like this in office and are willing to elevate somebody like Trump to office, there is no magic bullet here to ensure that a future Donald Trump won't take office.
Well, let me just say something. I know one thing I would do immediately. I would require all candidates running for president to reveal their tax returns and make it the law. And I think that even the Trump supporters would not be opposed to that. I think that there's something about transparency that even if you're to the right or to the left, you kind of like it. You know what I mean? You just think it's like an okay thing to do. It's like, you know, when you buy a house, you have to sort of disclose, except when you have liar loans. But anyway, you're supposed to disclose your income and whatever. And I do think that anything that we can embrace that will require these people and the people that he appoints or whatever, that there's a level of transparency and disclosure and make it the law. Not that it's been the norm that they've always done it. Make it not just that they have to disclose the last 2 years. They have to disclose the last decade is what they have to do. Be precise. Give people, and therefore it's a level playing field. You're not targeting Trump. You're saying going into the future, this is how you behave. And we already are offended. We're willing to tax the rich. You know that. We know about the revolving doors. I mean, conservatives are willing to tax the rich in very conservative states. We saw that happening, I think, in a couple of states on referendums. So don't you think there are certain things that it's not going to be offensive, but in fact will be embraced? Because until you're being told you really don't want to be transparent, most people's knee-jerk response is, sure, I think it's a good idea.
Oh, absolutely. I absolutely agree. And I think the best evidence of that is Trump's own campaign back in 2016. I think it's sort of faded because a lot of the last 4 years have seen like 4,000 years. But he was actually very aggressive on anti-corruption, at least verbally during the campaign. He frequently denounced Hillary Clinton for some of the sort of financial aspects of her political career. He was frequently critical of decisions like Citizens United. He frequently talked about getting money out of politics. I mean, he used the sort of image of him as a billionaire who would not be dependent or beholden to anybody, could not be bought.
And I think you could almost use his language when you write the bill. I mean, I would love to have a quote from Donald Trump about, I mean, even when it came to his tax returns, Yeah. Let's be honest. He never said you can't have them. Oh, they're not done yet. Oh, mañana. Oh, they're not done yet. Oh, they're not done yet. Well, that's bull. But if nothing else, but he didn't say you couldn't have them. Think about mm-hmm. that. So now you pass a law that says we can have them because we know that there's nothing that's stopping the IRS from sharing them with us, even if they're under audit. Am I right?
Oh, absolutely. And I think one of the reasons this candidacy resonated in 2016 was because of that anti-corruption message. You know, drain the swamp is not a bad idea if you're talking about getting money out of politics and ensuring that there's a level of transparency and anti-corruption efforts, as you said. It's just that he didn't actually mean it.
Yeah, exactly. Ken, you want to say something?
Yeah, I just wanted to get back to the conversation about not prosecuting Trump. And well, maybe people will learn their lesson because everybody knows how corrupt he was. How does it change your analysis, or how did it play into your analysis to realize that 70 plus million people still voted for Trump, even though everyone knew how corrupt he was and all the deals with his private properties, and he tried to have international meetings at his hotels, and he did succeed in having lots and lots of foreign people pay big bucks to stay in his hotels, and the news is all over his corruption before he got elected and everything, and Ivanka's corruption after he's elected.
The trademarks.
They knew about it, and it's just like the grab him by the you-know-what. You know, the public says, well, he stinks, but we still are voting for him. 70-plus million people. So how is our country going to ever get to the point where people, not just who are demagogues and horror shows like him, but people who are corrupt like him, are not going to get votes?
Well, I, you know, there are two thoughts about that. One is that, you know, I'll answer them in sort of a reverse order. One is that, you know, I think the good governance measures we've mentioned on transparency, on disclosing tax returns, on steps like that, they're not bulletproof. They're not going to guarantee that every presidential candidate in the future is going to be immaculate, but they will certainly help. Answering your broader point about, How do we rationalize the fact that that's, you know, 70 odd million people voted for this man? I think, you know, you have to give voters a certain amount of leeway. They don't necessarily, you know, a lot of people may have had very, you know, mixed feelings about him, but nonetheless voted for him just out of negative partisanship. Their belief that Democrats were simply worse. They may have just simply followed what friends on Facebook and on Fox News and sort of other conservative media outlets said. They may not have, you know, read the New York Times expose on his tax returns. And they may simply like aspects of his presidency and find themselves willing to overlook the rest. If you're somebody who's deeply concerned about the direction of the courts in a conservative direction, boy, is he the man for you.
Exactly.
I think voters will be willing to rationalize a lot to achieve what they see. And, you know, and certainly Democrats aren't immune to that. I mean, a lot of Bernie supporters are not necessarily great fans of Biden, but they certainly dislike Trump a lot more.
Well, what I love about what we can do going forward, and you're right, it's not a silver bullet and it's not magical and it won't fix everything. But I think in the end, I don't think the 70 million that voted for Donald Trump are going to say, no, you shouldn't disclose your tax returns. I just don't think they're going to say that. I mean, I think again, you can sort of use a little bit of his language as you do this and say, this is kind of, you know, a kind of a interesting kumbaya, but we just want to make sure that we have it in writing now because we don't want to be able to give a pass. And I just don't, there's not a lot of reason for them to say, don't do that. And because
Absolutely.
They won't have the oomph to not do that, then if we put it in place, at least if nothing else, we'll put some parameters on the behavior of the next person that's in office. And the good news is that Donald Trump has showed us everything that practically doesn't work. I mean, that's his gift. There isn't a door he hasn't kicked open. There isn't a scab he hasn't pulled off. And so if nothing else, you can sort of take notes and say, okay, we got to write this. We got to write that. We got to write this. And that's sad. But if nothing else, maybe he's been kind of useful.
But with all that transparency, Arnie, if he had to disclose his tax returns, everybody would have known before the election that he only paid $750 in taxes.
Matt Ford, if they had known that, then the other Republicans running against him could have used that. You see, this isn't just about Donald Trump. It's the Republicans that that basically fell away from him. You know, the Ted Cruzes, the Jeb Bushes. I mean, think about what Donald Trump was able to do to them. And if we had this in place, maybe they would have had a foothold against him because they would have had an angle to use that would have undermined his message. Am I right?
Well, yeah. I mean, he presented himself as a self-made billionaire who was a financial genius. Exposing his tax returns would have disproven that from the start.
And the $750, I would have written that one up and down the flagpole, and that would have been on every Facebook ad and every Twitter ad and everything else, and saying, okay, and which one have you paid $750? I think I want to be just like Donald Trump. Yeah, right. Anyway, Matt Ford, thank you for writing this. I'm so glad that Joe Biden sort of read your piece as well and said, well, maybe not. But it's entitled At the New Republic, The Case for Prosecuting Trump and His Cronies, How Biden Treats His Predecessor Could Determine the Fate of American Democracy. And you and I both know we're going to have our eyes focused on who he appoints as Attorney General, because what he says and who he's appointing may not necessarily be the same thing. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
It was a pleasure. All right, everyone. This is the Wednesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. We will schmooze tomorrow. Ciao.